Good morning. My name's Bob Taylor, and I'm going to share today with my associate, Justice Severson. I'd like to start out by letting the court know, or continuing to refuse the court, that the standard of review in this case is to know whether or not Congress's, Department of Commerce's determinations are lawful or unlawful, if it's supported by substantial evidence on the record or otherwise in accordance with the law. I plan to talk about three issues today, but I want to start first and foremost with the issue of zeroing, which was part of our motion to stay these proceedings on the basis of a WTO decision and agreement by the U.S. government to resolve the zeroing issue in this case in a 9-month period. The court did not grant the stay, but we laid out specifically in that motion why, in fact, the application of zeroing in this case would moot all the other issues, because the Department of Commerce is applying zeroing in this case, contrary to the Dunn Booth decision, which was issued about a month before our briefs, and JTAC, which was issued subsequent to our initial brief, but prior to our response brief. If, in fact, a final determination by the review of the zeroing issue is resolved in favor of requiring a consistent interpretation of the statute of what constitutes a dumping margin, both for investigations and reviews, there would be not only zero margins in this case, but hugely negative margins in this case. Because we didn't have the opportunity to know that Dunn Booth was going to come down when we first filed the appeal, or for that matter, the series of appeals for international trade, etc., and at the time, as was pointed out by this court in Dunn Booth, there had been seven different decisions in the last decade which affirmed the Department of Commerce's use of zero. It would have been inappropriate at the time for us to, again, to raise that to the courts. In fact, we would have been risking a Rule 11 sanction. We did raise zeroing in the administrative review, in the original review, because this was subsequent, the department's determination was subsequent to the change in practice by the Department of Commerce with respect to investigations. So we would ask the court to remand this case in accordance with Dunn Booth and JTAC.
This is the first time I remember a brief allusion when you raised the zero initially. It's the first time you made a request for this relief.
No, in fact, we requested this relief in our conclusion and our response brief, Your Honor.
In your reply brief?
In our reply brief.
You can't raise things for the first time.
Well, we appreciate that. We are caught in an issue. We did footnote Dunn Booth cited it in our original brief. And we did ask for relief in the response brief. And if the court doesn't accept that, in the case of JTAC, for the first time, the relief was asked at oral argument. So, and the court did reverse in accordance with Dunn Booth, or did remand.
Dunn Booth is clear enough on what the law is. What are the facts relevant to the law? Do they use zeroing and not to the other?
Yeah, they applied zeroing. This is the first administrative review in this Sunday case before the court. And the Department of Commerce uses its normal practice of applying zeroing in the review. And this review, the final determination, was subsequent to their change in practice.
Maybe I'm missing something, but I didn't think when you said zeroing was bad. I thought what you said was you can't change your practice in the middle of the same series.
Well, my understanding was that the change in practice was with regard to investigation and not with regard to reviews, and that the interpretation of the statute, which had the exact same language for both, could not be inconsistent. Now, in fact, they used zeroing in the original investigation in this case.
They did.
Because it was prior to, yes, because it was prior to that change.
And did they use zeroing in the follow-up investigation?
Well, in the first annual review, which is this case before the court, yes, they use zeroing again.
And your argument is that somehow...
That once they changed the practice, that zeroing could not be, that, as I understand Dunbar, and as I understand Jacob, that the department did not have a different interpretation of the same wording in the statute for an investigation and review.
I do not understand it. You can't do it two different ways.
But it's not my understanding, and I apologize to the court, it's not my understanding. It's not my understanding that the difference relates to the exact investigation and review series of activities. In fact, where the first administrative review, I believe the case in Tungu was the 12th or 14th administrative review.
Your understanding is if they go back to their so-called normal practice, they can't use zero at all.
That's correct. Once they change the practice under the statute, they can't use zero at all. That's correct. Let me move on then to the issue of new information. There was a series of preliminary determination in this case. There were a series of questions that came up that we foresaw that were mistakes. One in particular related to the home market risk levels of the orange juice, non-concentrated orange juice that was being compared with the U.S. sales price. As we laid out in our brief, BRICS level is simply a variable used by the Department of Commerce to convert a volume-based price to a pound solid-based price, a weight price. It has no effect on price other than making the conversion correct. The Fisher submitted incorrect information in his original questionnaire related to the BRICS levels of the home market sales. There were four home market sales. Three of them they had what were really the minimum allowable to the customer, 10.5.
How do we know that's the minimum allowable? I'll tell you what's bothering me about this issue is that I'm having a very hard time. I'm sympathetic with the overall legal proposition that you should be entitled to make the demonstration, even at full legally, that there's a clear calculation type error here and that Commerce should respond to it. Where I have trouble is the specificity and the clarity of your presentation to Commerce as to exactly what was going on, because it was I've read it with some care through the brief submitted to Commerce and through the backup information. And I'm having a hard time either seeing that you were consistent in what you were saying was wrong, or that you identified that what was done initially was a minimum as opposed to a standard as opposed to an actual use, and where the standard use came in as a recommended recourse. So can you straighten that out for me, starting with where I can find a clear indication that the 10.5 is a minimum?
My pleasure. I fully understand the first
question.
I understand fully because I've lived this, so okay. I understand fully. So, to answer the initial question, the Exhibit 3 in the rejected brief clearly shows the specification sheet, which shows that 10.5 is the minimum.
Okay, let's get real specific here.
Yep.
Is that exhibit in this? Because you cited us to pages. Well, the pages that are after the delivery, can you point me to the particular page?
JA 106.
106. Okay. All right. Now that was where did this document come from?
This document comes from the company.
Okay, and this was submitted by the company with this brief?
This was submitted by the company with a brief. After the preliminary determination, with that brief, it was Exhibit 3.
All right.
And you can see in the first line, Fritz corrected USDA minimum 10.5.
Well, then, why do you say at the bottom of 84 the department's use of actual bricks in lieu of the regulatory standard bricks results in a distortion.
Yeah,
you're saying that now that you were telling the agency in your brief that it's actual, and you're telling them in your exhibit that it's minimal.
There was a whole huge discussion over the U.S. sales contracts, which required a standard bricks. No. 11.8 was the standard bricks under the contracts that the U.S. sales were sold upon.
Right.
The fundamental argument that we were making at the time and throughout was that the standard bricks under that contract, that's what the comparison is. The argument has always been, and I would agree, this record is a bit confusing, the argument has always been that you don't need to use bricks, you don't need to make this conversion. But we accept the fact that the Department of Commerce has the discretion to make the conversion because they're used to doing it for knock-in concentrates, which is always on a weight basis. And understanding that certain deductions are easier to do with respect to the weight basis. So we're okay with that. We said you can make it, but if you make it, the bricks levels in the home market, when you make your conversion to the new home market pound solids, and you make your conversion from the on the U.S. side, from the knock-in concentrate to the pound solids, the price effect has to be neutral. And in fact, in this questionnaire, in the A questionnaire that we first responded to the Department of Commerce, we specifically said that 11.8 was the bricks conversion basis.
For both, the
struggle was that there is no standard on the home market side as to what standard bricks number is. I mean, there's the USDA.
The USDA, in other words, USDA
has a clear standard.
In the US, you've got to get up to 11.8.
The standard bricks is recognized in the US as 11.8 for not to concentrate. And it was specifically in the contract for that basis. In fact, it doesn't have to be a minimum. There could be pricing adjustments that take place if you're lower. So when the Department of Commerce came out with preliminary determination, when we saw the margin, we said, what's going on here? They said, we used actual bricks. We used actual bricks to do this comparison. And at that point, we saw what the information supplied to the Department of Commerce was a very low bricks in the home market.
10.5.
Right.
The
effect of that is when you convert the volume.
I know it's a bad effect. Saying you use the minimum bricks at the home and you use the standard, i.e., actual. Purposes in the U.S. sales, and therefore that creates a problem. You say the department used actual bricks as opposed to standard, right?
They used actual bricks for their conversion. And we supplied in that Exhibit 3, which was rejected, not only the specification sheets, but the actual bricks for each of those sales based on the packing slip at the time. In other words, in that Exhibit 3 that was rejected, we said, hey, we were pointing that the 10.5 is the minimum, which gave them the sheet, and we provided the information of the actual bricks for each sale,
right,
which were significantly different than the 10.5 and would have a significantly different outcome when converted from the volume base to the pound solid.
But you asked them to use the standard bricks.
We were arguing for the standard bricks in the rejected brief, and later on, we didn't have the information on the record because if they rejected, Department of Commerce said, look, you need to eliminate this information, and resubmit. So it's
using your mind. The fact that they required you to throw all that out, if you had made a showing that was clear that you were entitled to the relief you were asking for, then the fact that they threw the record at the materials, that wouldn't hurt you. You could still be making exactly
the error
now.
Yes, in hindsight, absolutely. But under NTN Bearing and Timken. The fact that they had the information that was a pure variable that was strictly for doing a calculation is the critical point. Whether we pointed out in our briefs, whatever our theories were on the briefs, once we gave them the corrective information, it was not new information. It was not untimely information and should have been used. And there was no burden here because, in fact, you had three sales. That was it. But the burden is about $3 million in dumping duties because of that calculation.
Do you want to say anything very briefly about the inventory issue?
No, I was going to focus really on the regulation itself. There was a sale that was prior to the suspension of liquidation in this case, that the home market sale that was used to compare under the Department's 1960-day rules to come to a comparison price. We have taken we firmly believe that the regulation does not allow for that. That the review regulation has very different language when you're looking at the period of review, the first annual administrative review, and all those. And the language is, clear on its face. 351.213(e)(1) for all other reviews. It says review under this section normally will cover as appropriate entries, exports, or sales of the subject merchandise during 12 months of the subject merchandise. E1(2), an administrative review, which is the first annual review, under this section will cover. It doesn't say normally will cover. It says will cover. As appropriate, entries, exports, or sales during the period from the date of suspension of liquidation. Does not say subject merchandise. Does not say U.S. merchandise. The regulation says that in many other places, but in this particular regulation, which applies only to the first administrative review, which is this review, those words do not appear. It is very narrow. Will cover. Does not say subject. Thank you very much.
May it please the court. Before I turn to my remarks on the issues that were actually briefed in this case, a note about zeroing, which is that it is totally inappropriate for plaintiff to be raising, or petitioner to be raising an issue for the first time before this court that was not briefed, that indeed was not even part of the claims that were raised in the complaint in this matter. And what my intention to do is to actually address the issues that were briefed in this matter and then come back at the end to zero in and address that issue.
You realize that the court can ask questions which might take counsel into a new direction.
Yes, I understood, Your Honor, and I'm prepared to answer any questions that you're on.
In that case, let's go in a new direction.
Okay.
How do we not remand on the zeroing issue? Do you concede that zeroing was used in this case?
Zeroing was used in this case in both the investigation.
My understanding that zeroing is no longer the policy of the Commerce Department.
That's not correct. Commerce in some time ago, determined not to continue using zeroing in certain types of investigations, but continue to use it in administrative code.
We've outlawed that.
Well, the court has remanded for further explanation in Dongwu and JCAC. But the issue here,
Dongwu, we said you got to explain it, and the second case, they said we explained it, and we said no, you didn't. Is there any real doubt in your mind that they got to go one way or the other, and if so, doesn't this case say, wait a minute, we got to find out what the answer is?
Well, first, Your Honor, the second case is JTEC, and JTEC did not say the explanation is unreasonable. That was another instance in which the party hadn't brought a specific argument before Commerce. The Commerce had, we argued that Commerce had made an argument, made its reasoning more detail about zeroing in the review, and the court said that reasoning isn't good enough. We're remanding it back for you to provide further explanation consistent with Dongbu. So even in JTEC, the court still hadn't ruled on one way or another. In both cases, it's been remanded to the Court of International Trade, and the Court of International Trade Commerce's final remand results with the further explanation that the court had sought in both of those cases. But to step back for a moment, again, zeroing, as the court correctly noted, was not and has never been an issue in this appeal. It is well established that a party cannot raise a new argument on reply or in a footnote. In this case,
even if the law changes while the briefing is going on,
the law has not changed while the briefing is going on. The Dongbu decision was issued before the briefs in this case. First of all, just to clear up.
To get to the merits of the argument and the issues that have been raised.
In not doing the other issues that were raised in the briefing.
Whatever you believe you want to direct our attention to,
okay.
You have 8 minutes and 26 seconds in which to do so.
Okay. Let me first focus on the issue of the BRICS levels. This is not a case about whether Commerce is authorized to correct mistakes. This is a case about whether Commerce acted reasonably based on records and the arguments that were before it in this case. If there is any doubt in this case about whether Fisher was making an attempt to bring a mistake or error to Commerce's attention with respect to the BRICS level that reported, that doubt is resolved by the fact that Fisher was not even citing the documents that it now claims were corrective information concerning the BRICS level in support of its BRICS level argument. So in particular, Petitioner's counsel was incorrect when he stated during his remarks that Exhibit 3 included this corrective information.
And he cited us to JA-106, and of course also to JA-85, which contains the reference to the 3, right?
Right.
And are you saying that JA-106, well, unfortunately, it happens a lot, and it's very frustrating, although I know our rules are a little confused on this, but we don't have the whole set of exhibits to go along with this brief, so we're at your mercy.
That
tell us whether this 106 was part of the Exhibit 3 or not.
That's something I can clarify here.
All right.
So first of all, if you look at JA 85 and 86, which is where Fisher made the argument, Fisher is only citing Exhibits 1, 2, and 3.
All right.
And that takes us through JA 106 in the record.
What exhibit is JA 106?
JA 106 is Exhibit 3.
All right, well, that's what it says.
Right.
The minimum level is normally providing the specification sheet, and that says minimum 10.5.
Right, and so there's nothing erroneous about that.
Okay.
Fisher reported a number of BRICS levels.
Well, what is it that he said was wrong?
Right, so what he said that was wrong is that everything after that in the record, which actually includes the information that Fisher said it offered to quote-unquote correct the BRICS level, is not Exhibit 3. That is Exhibit 4 to Fisher's case brief. And that contains these packing slips that supposedly offer what Fisher now says is the correct BRICS level. Those documents were offered in support of an entirely different argument that Fisher was making. Exhibit 4 is cited later on in the case brief, and it's about some of the issues here, the 1960-day rule, the inventory carrying cost. But those documents... That's right. That's right. But now,
11.8 in the U.S., I guess.
Well, no. Fisher also was claiming that the actual BRICS levels are measured by the USDA in the United States, and Fisher was arguing that in both cases one should use standard BRICS levels.
Standard BRICS level for the U.S.
It argued standard BRICS levels for the U.S. as opposed to actual, and standard BRICS levels for the home market as opposed to actual.
Right, the standard BRICS level for Brazil is 5.5.
That's right. We're saying you shouldn't use any actuals. you should use standard in the U.S. and standard here.
And that's an apples to apples, at least presumably.
Right, right. Commerce action, what is not at issue here, that Commerce uses actual info. And that was affirmed by the trial court in
Commerce appeals. Commerce uses actual for the U.S., but minimum for Brazil, right?
Well, Commerce seeks to use actual for Brazil as well.
That's not the use in this case, right?
Well, Fisher reported its BRICS level as actual BRICS. What Fisher was saying, to the extent Fisher reported some of these sales at 10.5, Fisher was saying these are actual BRICS for those sales.
The only place I could find that, any other reference to 10.5 besides JA106, was in that very long list of, let's see if I can find it now, I've lost my pad. Well, go ahead, I will find it.
Well, the point is that Fisher was claiming that Fisher is now claiming, no, we were saying that our minimum
site on page 75 and 76, items 366, 432, and 460 all have BRICS H 10.5.
Right.
But there's nothing to indicate, at least for an untutored eye like mine, that that's minimum versus our action.
That's exactly right. And the documents that Fisher is now saying show that there was a different BRICS level that were actual are in Exhibit 4. They're packing slips that Fisher is saying, we offered these documents to show that the BRICS level was wrong, but it didn't offer those documents to show that the BRICS level was wrong. It made an argument, a methodological argument about standard BRICS versus actual BRICS. And those documents happen to be in the record. What's problematic here is the notion that a party can kind of simply dump a bunch of documents in the record and then claim ex post for the first time in litigation that actually what we were doing is trying to correct a mistake. And neither the NPN decision nor the Timken decision stand for that.
So you're saying that Commerce ultimately concluded that 10.5 was the actual BRICS for each of the transactions in the home market?
Well, that's actually not quite correct. Commerce concluded that the BRICS that Fisher had reported BRICS and saying these are our actual BRICS. Commerce relied on that.
That's the thing. I keep getting hung up on that point as you go through the sequence.
Yep.
Where did Fisher say that 10.5 was the actual BRICS?
In his questionnaires, Commerce asked, report the BRICS of the sale. And so in providing the documents, these are the documents at page 75, 76 of the record, similar document at page 148 to 152 of the record. These are the sales that Fisher reported as the actual BRICS
sales. Okay, I was just looking at 75 and 76, it was responsive to a question as to what is the actual BRICS.
What are the BRICS? The better document to look at is at 148 to 152, because what that document shows is what the court noted in its opinion, which is that Fisher was coming into the trial court and saying, all of the BRICS we reported were at a minimum level. Fisher, again, was not citing any of the documents it cites now, saying that actually we gave you other documents showing the BRICS were at a different level. But it said each of the items we reported were at a minimum level, and the trial court looked at the document at page 148 and noted that actually the BRICS levels that Fisher reported varied. And I would particularly point your honors to line 400 and 460 of that document. And so what the court ruled that it was perfectly reasonable for Commerce, given the record in front of it, given that Fisher wasn't making any arguments about we made a mistake, and the fact that the BRICS levels it was looking at, and these are excerpts of the overall database, varied, that it was perfectly reasonable for Commerce to determined that it was looking at the actual BRICS.
Well, Mr. Carlin, that may be true, that it's perfectly reasonable for them to do it, but is it or is it not the case that the BRICS level reported, at least to some extent, were erroneously reported? Is that true or is it not true?
We don't know the answer to that, and for several reasons. First of all, as the court noted, the BRICS vary. Second of all, if you look at the results of the remand that the trial court took in this case, so the second Fisher decision, the court did remand one of the issues, in which it did determine that Fisher had fairly made an argument about that we reported something erroneously. And on remand, determined that the information that Fisher claimed showed that there was an error was not Commerce determined, and the court affirmed that it didn't reliably show that there was an error. So, again, you have an instance where Fisher is not claiming it made a mistake, it's not pointing to the document it's now claiming showed that it made a mistake, and Commerce was simply not given an opportunity to address that issue, but it's certainly not, we certainly do not agree that there was certainly a mistake made here.
Now, at this point in life, is there evidence that there was a mistake made?
No, there isn't evidence that there was a mistake made. Fisher has submitted a couple of packing slips that it claims show that there was an error. But no, we don't know whether there was a mistake made. And that's what the court noted in Timpin and NTN, that it's permissible for a party to come in at the preliminary stage and say, look, we made an error, please fix it. But once you get past the preliminary stage, which we did here, to the final stage, concerns about finality begin. It's simply not appropriate for a party in litigation and then on appeal to first claim that we made an error. And
But I thought NTN and Timken were post, were untimely requests for new information. Was it untimely but still before the preliminary results?
It was after
the preliminary results.
It was untimely but still before the final results.
Yeah, but that's true here too.
But that's not true here in that
this brief was filed after the preliminary and before the final, right?
That's true, but
then
the brief. Because here, in Timken and NTN, the parties actually made an argument about error in their case.
Yeah, but that goes to the merits of whether or not they adequately called your Commerce's attention to the problem, not what I thought you were saying, which is this case involves a different stage in the process from Timken and NTN.
Well,
this is the same stage in the process, correct?
It's not the same stage in the process.
I mean, what is the difference between this case and Timken and NTN with respect to the stage and process?
Because Fisher only raised an issue of mistake and indeed only cited documents that it's now claiming show the mistake in litigation before the Court of International Trade.
But if you look at the question, if you assume for purposes of our argument that what Fisher filed was a perfectly adequate document calling your attention to the mistake, then this case would be timeliness-wise on all fours with the other two, correct?
Yes, and Commerce would consider that allegation of mistake.
Right. Well, that's all I was saying. I thought you were saying that it was a different.
All
right. Okay. So there is no bar to their bringing in the evidence.
There is a bar to bringing in the evidence in the sense that Fisher did not offer the evidence as we have to deal with the facts in front of us. Fisher did not offer the evidence in connection with an allegation of mistake.
Your argument, is it not? It's just not that there's a problem with the timing so much as they just didn't make an adequate showing that there was an error. Period. End case. Isn't that your argument?
They didn't make an adequate showing, but they didn't even make an argument that there was an error. And so.
Now, do you
still want to
give
the
some time or not?
I do, Your Honor. Let me make two very, very short points.
We're going over time. We'll make them very short, all right.
Okay. With respect to the inventory carrying cost issue, the standard review is actually abuse of discretion. That's in the F. Lilly DiCecco case that Fisher cited in its brief. Here, the trial court did not abuse its discretion. It thoroughly examined the record and determined that Fisher had not raised this inventory carrying cost. Second of all, I'll leave it to Mr. McGrath to speak to this. We have checked and double-checked. The issue is simply moved. Commerce did not use the inventory carrying cost.
That's your point, that it won't have any impact on the outcome.
That's right. This figure was not used in Commerce's calculations at all.
No, we need to.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. May it please the Court, I'm Matt McGrath of Barnes Richardson, representing petitioners in this case, Florida Citrus Mutual. I will be very brief. I concur in everything the government has said about these issues. I wanted to add one observation to maybe add to the discussion here of NTN and the ability to make corrections. I represented NTN in that case. It's hard to imagine 17 years ago. And the big difference between this one and that one is that the errors were in transcription, in the submissions themselves that went to the agency. They were discovered right after the preliminary determination and brought to attention of the Commerce Department immediately. And we went to the Commerce Department and pointed out, these are the errors. These are what the correct data should be. It was simply transcribed error and an incorrect digit went into a classification of the merchandise, and that resulted in a margin that didn't need to be there. So
you would certainly agree with you that if this case involved a simple, straightforward statement, immediately after the preliminary results, it said, well, you used actual bricks in connection with the U.S. sales, and you used minimal bricks with respect to home sales. And here's the proof of it, and the proof were absolutely plain and clear. But that would be something Commerce would have not only the opportunity, but the obligation to consider.
They would consider it, I'm sure, if they were presented with information.
And if they didn't, we'd reverse them, correct?
Pardon?
And if they didn't, we would reverse them under the authority of NTN. I guess where I'm going, this is to try to see if there's any significance to your statement that, well, NTN was a case involving just calculation.
Right.
This would be similarly the same kind of error correct in terms of its cognizability under NTN and HIPAA, even at the preliminary, post-preliminary stage, correct?
Yes, it would, Your Honor.
All right.
It could be considered in that fashion. And my point was simply that there is a significant difference between it. Both cases happened right after the preliminary determination, but there's a very significant difference in how the alleged errors were presented. In this case, they were never presented until it reached litigation long after the final determination. It's very difficult to imagine a scenario where these issues can remain open indefinitely without specific identification of errors that can be corrected by the agency. It was not identified. The other issue I did want to also mention, Mr. Kerman mentioned, is the inventory carrying cost issue. Not quite clear why we've spent time discussing it here. We've looked at, and you can refer to the appendix pages 164 to 168, specific lines in those appendices. I'm sorry, 163 to 168. Specific lines there indicate that there was no consideration of inventory carrying costs in calculating the margin in this case. This discussion of how it's calculated is moved.
Thank you
very much.
Mr. Taylor, you
have
some time.
Thank you. There's two quick points. The first, dealing with the bricks issue now, is bricks. The argument at the time was about the use of standard bricks. Very clearly stated to the Department of Commerce that what we submitted was minimum bricks, and that was the purpose of putting that exhibit in place. Commerce was unnoticed that home market bricks was incorrect. If they had accepted the exhibits, and I apologize for Exhibit 3 and Exhibit 4, confusing, but if they had accepted the exhibits on the record, the correct information would be there. I just want to close with pointing out on the whole zeroing issue, which was done in our briefs as well, Hormel versus Halloween, the Supreme Court case, which very specifically says there may always be exceptional cases or particular circumstances which would prompt a reviewing or appellate court where injustice might otherwise result to consider questions of law that were neither pressed nor passed upon by the court or the administrative agency. I just think that Hormel versus Halbrand does control this issue as whether or not it's appropriate for us to raise the law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kerman. Mr. McGrath, you can just take it into submission. That concludes the argument cases.
Sorry. All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock a.m.